Thank you, Professor McLean. Let me say, first of all, it's a pleasure to be here this morning, and let me say also how delighted I am that the Philadelphia Society has devoted its national meeting this year to an examination of some of the important topics that constitute the philosophy of law. As many of you know, interest and work in this area has burgeoned over the past decade and more on the part of both philosophers and lawyers, and in their own way on the part of some economists as well. I'm afraid, however, that the better part of that work has been carried on by those who stand substantially opposed to the ideas that define this society. In large measure, of course, we've directed our attention over the years to economic matters and to policy studies generally, and accordingly have won a good part of the battle in these areas. By contrast, we've come rather more haltingly to the legal and jurisprudential arenas, and in particular to the workings of the courts. This is all the more unfortunate when we realize that our policy findings, if they are to be more than scholarly studies, must win their approval in the end, not only in the political and legislative arenas, but in the judicial arena as well, which is where our legal order is ultimately shaped. This brings me then to my first topic, to the problem of judicial review. Without question, no subject has more centrally occupied the American jurisprudential mind over the years than this, and no one perhaps has put the matter more clearly than a visitor to this country, Professor H.L.A. Hart, speaking at the law school at the University of Georgia in 1977, shortly after his retirement from the chair in jurisprudence at University College, Oxford. In that important address, which he entitled American Jurisprudence Through English Eyes, The Nightmare and the Noble Dream, Professor Hart observed that American jurisprudence, that is, American speculative thought about the general nature of law, is marked by a concentration almost to the point of obsession on the judicial process, that is, with what courts do and should do, how judges reason and should reason in deciding particular cases. That, the simple explanation of that concentration, he went on to say, is the quite extraordinary role that the courts, above all the United States Supreme Court, play in American government. Citing de Tocqueville, scarcely any political question arises in the United States that is not resolved sooner or later into a judicial question. But a more complete explanation, Hart continued, would point to two important factors that have served to secure this role and status for the Supreme Court. The first was, of course, the Supreme Court's own decision in Marbury v. Madison and later in McCulloch v. Maryland that, quote, it had power to review and declare unconstitutional and so invalid enactments of Congress as well as of the state legislatures. The second was its doctrine that the clause of the Fifth Amendment and the later 14th Amendment, providing that no person should be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, referred not merely to matters of form or procedure, but also to the content of legislation, so that, to an English lawyer's astonishment, even a statute of Congress of impeccable clarity, passed by an overwhelming majority, and conforming to all procedural requirements specified in the Constitution, might still be held invalid because its interference with individual liberty or with property did not satisfy the requirement of a vague, undefined standard of reasonableness or desirability, a doctrine which came to be called substantive due process, end of quote. Now, as a matter of legal and ideological history, this doctrine of substantive due process has cut both ways, of course. Between the Civil War and the New Deal, for example, the court repeatedly struck down a wide range of legislation aimed at regulating economic activity. And it did so because it found this legislation to interfere with various constitutional rights, especially with the right to freedom of contract, all of which led to Justice Holmes' famous dissent in the 1905 Lochner case, to wit, that the 14th Amendment had not enacted Herbert Spencer's social statics or an economic philosophy of laissez-faire. Although this period is often characterized as one of judicial activism, a more precise description, I believe, would be one of judicial negativism. For the court has been not so much active in creating new law and new rights as it was active in securing existing law and rights by prohibiting the enforcement of such new law as would abolish those rights. More recently, however, the court has in fact been active in the direct sense of finding new rights and hence new law that heretofore had not been either recognized or written as a matter of statute. The abortion decisions of 1973 come most strikingly to mind in this connection. But many other decisions as well have all amounted to a period of judicial activism that is cut in an ideological direction quite opposite that of the earlier period. The basic issues in the matter of judicial review, then, are plainly more than ideological, as is illustrated at the moment by the 20 or more bills before the Congress that would bar the Supreme Court and lower federal courts from hearing cases involving abortion, school desegregation, and school prayer. While introduced by conservative legislators, frustrated over recent court decisions that impede them from translating the mandate of November last into political change, still other conservatives are concerned about the balance of powers implications of these bills. Whether or not they turn out to be permitted under Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution, about which there is considerable uncertainty. Moreover, the second group of conservatives is concerned as well that such a move can also cut both ways. In future, that is, a liberal Congress might as easily remove its favorite programs from review by, say, a conservative Reagan court, leaving us to the tyranny of the liberal legislative majority, much as liberals today fear the possible tyranny of a conservative legislative majority. At bottom, then, the problem of judicial review arises simply because we do not live in a pure democracy, but rather in a republic wherein the will of the legislature is subject to scrutiny by the reason of the court, however much those attributes may seem today to be reversed. In this fundamental arrangement, in fact, and in particular in our distrust of unbridled democracy, friends of liberty can agree even with Professor Ronald Dworkin, who assumed the Oxford chair from which Professor Hart retired. Writing in the New York Review of Books on the jurisprudence of Richard Nixon, Professor Dworkin put the point quite plainly, and I quote, "The constitutional theory on which our government rests is not a simple majoritarian theory. The Constitution, and particularly the Bill of Rights, is designed to protect individual citizens and groups against certain decisions that a majority of citizens might want to make, even when that majority acts in what it takes to be the general or common interest," end of quote. Our rights are there, in short, to stand athwart the utilitarian calculus. They serve to break the democratic engine. Now, just what those rights are and how we know that we have them, if indeed we do, are critical questions, of course, to which we will presently turn. Moreover, they are questions whose answers will go far toward separating most of us in this society from Professor Dworkin. But whatever the content of our rights turns out to be, if we do indeed have them, whether as a matter of constitutional declaration or as a matter of higher law, then it will not do to say that the judicial review that has cited them has frustrated some majority will. For even in a regime of judicial passivism, as is the case, for example, with much of our modern land use and zoning legislation, wherein the courts simply defer to legislative judgment, those courts will nonetheless be finding rights, if only by default. The legislation such courts let stand, that is legislation that entails obligations correlative to which our rights, whether or not the courts have noticed those rights with any explicit language to that effect. Talk of rights is inescapable, then, even in a regime of judicial passivism. When it will do to complain about judicial review, however, is when judges err, when they let stand legislation that should be overturned, or they discover rights that are not there to be discovered, which I submit is precisely what recent courts have so often done. But in that case, it is not the process of judicial review as such that is at fault. Rather, the error is in the execution of that process in the substantive decisions the judges have reached. This brings me then to my second concern, to the methods of judicial review, which will lead in turn to a consideration of what those methods accomplish and where they must eventually end. If a basic function of judicial review is to determine whether given statutes or practices violate the rights of individuals, it is a prerequisite of that determination, of course, to determine just what those individual rights are. But in this, the Constitution itself will be of limited assistance. For the rights that are set forth there, and in the Bill of Rights in particular, are described in only the broadest of terms, which it is the business of judges to more precisely define. The right to liberty, for example, might be invoked as easily by a poor woman seeking an abortion at state expense as by a taxpayer seeking to avoid that exaction, or a homeowner seeking a zoning exception, or a manufacturer seeking relief from foreign competition. Clearly, the founders could not have specified our every right, if for no other reason than that we have in principle an infinite number of rights, owing to the inventiveness that language permits. What they did instead, then, was to fasten upon a few of the broadest descriptions, life, liberty, and property, for example, leaving it to subsequent jurists to interpret those broad descriptions to flesh out the detail as cases arose. Just how those jurists were supposed to go about that work, however, has been the subject of a very large literature. It has often been noted, in fact, that it is precisely at this point that the practice of law begins to merge with the practice of philosophy. Nevertheless, there are certain recognized avenues along which judicial interpretation has proceeded when it has had to go beyond the literal language of the Constitution, as most often it has. Jurists have referred, for example, to the intentions of the framers, as set forth in such documents as the Declaration or the Federalist Papers. Or again, they have referred to precedent, especially in the form of the English common law tradition. Similarly, statutes, as well as custom and usage, have served as the source of rights. And finally, jurists have cited such diverse sources as learned opinion, conceptions of social value, and often principles of reason, however broad their understanding of this final idea. And in all of this, they have employed canons of reason, more or less. Yet with each of these methods, there are well-known shortcomings. The intentions of the framers, for example, are often obscure, or not in agreement with each other, or not dispositive of the case at hand. Similarly, statutes or custom, or the precedents of common law, have all been unclear at times, or inconsistent, or inapposite. Learned opinion, of course, is frequently divided. And finally, the use of reason, notwithstanding the honorific universality that has ever attended our conception of that faculty, has too often turned out to be a notorious subterfuge for the use of the particular values or prejudice of the jurist, not excluding his own conception of contemporary social values. But in all of this, there is a deeper problem still, which afflicts each of these methods, accepting only certain uses of reason. That problem is the same problem that afflicts legal positivism generally, namely, that even when we can unambiguously identify our legal rights, and even when we do this by tracing them to the Constitution itself, it is still an open question whether those rights are justified as a matter of ethics. Insofar as judicial review limits itself to legal materials and legal criteria, that is, it will yield legal rights only. For constitutional positivism, like legal positivism generally, is a descriptive or declaratory undertaking. It is not a justificatory undertaking in any deeper moral sense, and should not be confused for such. In particular, it should not be supposed that to have traced a right to the Constitution is to have given a moral justification of that right. Rather, it is simply to have shown that the right claimed is recognized in our legal system. Now, it may turn out, of course, that our constitutional rights can also be justified as moral rights. That is a desideratum in the American context especially, wherein governments are instituted among men, we declared to the world, to secure their moral rights. But if this happy congruity between the legal and the moral does indeed turn out to be the case, that will be a function not only of legal but of moral theory as well, and a fortunate accident of legal history besides. It will mean, in our case, that the founders got it right. Right as a matter of ethics. Now, in my view, they did get it right, at least for the most part, as I will try to indicate in a moment. But other peoples and other founders were not so fortunate, as a look around the world and a look at the Soviet Constitution in particular quite plainly suggests. Yet none of this can be determined at all unless we go behind the particular Constitution under review, unless we look to the higher law background that may or may not inform it. But why, it may be asked, does it matter that the legal order reflect the moral order as much as possible? And why do we need to draw this connection and remind ourselves of it from time to time? Is it not enough, that is, that we trace out the world of legal rights? Why do we have to go on to justify those rights against deeper moral criteria? Clearly, there are many answers to these questions. Let me focus, however, upon just two lines of response. In the first place, it plainly gives comfort to many to know that our legal regime, and hence that our use of force, is in conformity with the canons of ethics. This, in turn, lends legitimacy to our law, which encourages obedience without recourse to the police state. Nowhere is that state more required, of course, than in regimes where a great disparity obtains between the legal and moral orders. It is important to notice, moreover, that the obedience I speak of here is not simply unwilling compliance. Morally legitimate law, that is, tends to encourage not merely legal obedience, but moral behavior as well. Legal commands not in conformity with the moral law, however, lead at least to moral schizophrenia and often to civil disobedience where that is possible. A second line of argument for drawing the connection between the legal and the moral, however, is perhaps more basic and certainly more germane to the issues at hand. For if ours is indeed a regime that purports to be grounded in fundamental moral considerations, It is frequently necessary to go to those wellsprings simply to get clear about what the legal order is. As indicated earlier, our law is often not clear. When in the course of review, a jurist has exhausted all the legal sources available to him, and these have not availed, he will then have to turn to the basic grounds that give rise to the law in the first place, just as the founders did when they set about the creation of this regime. But here he will be doing ethics, not law. He will be asking not what is the law, but what ought the law to be. And in this he will be coming, if not straightforwardly, as did the founders, then by necessity, upon the nexus between the legal and the moral that has ever fascinated and vexed the philosophy of law. This brings me, then, to my third and principal concern this morning. To those higher law grounds a jurist might legitimately cite by way of more precisely determining what our rights are, in sum, to the foundations of justice. This is a vast and complex subject, of course, which I am not going to dispose of here. Nevertheless, I do want to raise several issues, all directed more or less to my earlier claim that for the most part the founders did get it right. Right as a matter of ethics. In order to give focus to these issues, however, it will be useful to mention here some of the conclusions toward which I will be driving. In this connection, let me note, too, the ambiguity that surrounds the very idea of foundations of justice. That idiom can refer to the basic principles of justice, such as those I am about to mention, from which more particular principles and rules may be deduced. Or foundations of justice can refer to the arguments that support those basic principles. All too often, I am afraid, moral argument is content with the former. It is content, that is, simply to announce the basic principles of justice, when in fact the real and difficult case must be made at the still deeper level of analysis that may or may not support those principles. I will say more about this second level of analysis in a moment. For the present, however, let me try to enunciate those principles. In the American legal order, they all relate, in one way or another, to the foundation that objectively defines our basic unit, the individual. That defining foundation is property, broadly understood to include title in life, liberty, and estate. In so stating the matter, I allude, of course, to the seminal importance of John Locke to our moral, political, and legal order, though his was only the most influential of the many voices that were developing a similar theme in the 17th and 18th centuries. And I allude as well to the recent work of Professor Robert Nozick of the philosophy department at Harvard, whose entitlement theory of justice has freshly stated our defining principles, giving them greater precision in the process. Among other things, Professor Nozick has shown that justice is historical, that whether a given distribution of holdings is just depends not upon whether that distribution reflects some preconceived pattern, a pattern of equality, for example, or merit, or effort, or whatever, but rather upon whether the distribution arose by a just process, whether the history of the matter was just, in particular, whether any rights were violated in the course of that history. That there are rich and poor, then, is in itself quite irrelevant to the question whether there is justice or injustice. In particular, this fact gives us no warrant whatever for redistributing holdings, an undertaking that would be justified only if rights were violated in a particular historical sequence. This much, of course, simply elucidates the point that justice is a matter of history or process, not a matter of what Nozick calls end states, as is argued, for example, by various egalitarian theories. In order to flesh the picture out, however, in order to know more precisely what it is we have rights to and how those rights get violated, we have to enunciate the three principles that constitute the entitlement theory. The first of these is the principle of justice in original acquisition, whereby original holdings are rightly held if they are acquired from the state of nature where they are unheld. Let me note parenthetically that this is not precisely Nozick's argument. Rather, it is what he should have said in his treatment of the Lockean proviso. Moreover, Nozick did not set forth a detailed argument aimed at showing how it is that we have exclusive title over our lives and liberties, unlike in many socialized states, for example. That argument can be developed, however, along lines I will sketch in a moment. The second principle is that of justice in transfer, whereby holdings are rightly held if they have been acquired by voluntary transfer from those who rightly hold them. Finally, in the principle of justice in restitution, we have the complex account of what justice requires when the principle of justice in transfer has been violated, when holdings have been transferred or extinguished by non-voluntary means, as by torts or crimes. Taken together, these three principles state the basic idea behind the whole of our private law, our law of property, contract, and torts, respectively, as this law has unfolded more or less through the course of the common law. That basic idea is one of voluntary association, which is to say, one of individual liberty. Defined with reference to the real content of that liberty, its material foundation, namely property. As such, violations of our rights amount to takings of our property, takings of our lives, liberties, and estates. Thus, we get clear about what our rights are by getting clear about what our property is. Rights, then, are not the same as values, nor are they the same as interests, even important interests, interests that rise to the level of rights, as the modern legal view would have it. There are many things that we value and many things in which we have an interest, but these are not ours by right unless we hold title to them free and clear. OMB Director David Stockman was perfectly correct then when he recently remarked on ABC's Issues and Answers that, and I quote, "The idea that's been established over the last 10 years that almost every service that someone might need in life ought to be provided, financed by the government as a matter of basic right, is wrong," end of quote. It is wrong indeed. We have by right only that which is ours to begin with, or that which has become ours through the processes just mentioned. Whatever else there is we may value and wish to have, but unless we hold title, such things are not ours by right. Thus do we define our separate beings by the material foundations that describe the limits of our individual liberty, the same material foundations, not incidentally, that permit our liberty. This much covers, in broad outline at least, the basic principles or content of justice. It does not tell us, however, just why those principles are justified, as opposed to such competing principles as have been put forward by Karl Marx, say, or by John Rawls or Ronald Dworkin. Why, for example, does first possession entail title, with its attendant rights and correlative obligations? Why cannot need or even want do the same? Granted that property is an incalculable aid to casuistry, which is the principal task of the jurist, it is immeasurably more useful because more real than such concepts as liberty or equality. But how do we get from property to rights, and how do we know these things? It is here, of course, that we move to the second level of analysis mentioned earlier, and that we come up against the two great traditions in metaethics or moral epistemology: moral skepticism, the view that there are no moral truths, or that if there are, we cannot know them, and moral cognitivism, the view that the truths of ethics are indeed true and demonstrable. Let me say here that I am afraid in this age-old dispute that skepticism has had the better of the day, and certainly it has since David Hume announced his simple but profound observation that from matters of fact one could not deduce matters of value, that statements about what is the case cannot serve as deductive ground for statements about what ought to be the case. Notwithstanding last evening's discussion, this was a telling blow to ethics, undermining traditional natural law and natural rights as well, whether stemming from the ancients or from the moderns, from Aristotle or from Locke. For each of those theories sought to derive its moral conclusions from certain factual premises, premises about the ends of man, for example, or about our natural equality in a state of nature. Yet this same objection applies as well to the various consequentialist theories, from utilitarianism to the wealth maximization approach taken by the modern economic analysis of law, especially as this last has been put forward in the recent normative work of Professor Richard Posner, speaking from the law school at the University of Chicago. For even if it is shown that a given legal arrangement maximizes society's wealth, and even if we set aside the distributive issues this formulation elides, from this observation, nothing at all follows about what we ought to do, much less about what we have a right to do. Nor is any of this helped by tying such consequentialist theories into democratic political theories, as recent work in decision theory and in the theory of anarchism has shown. For almost never do majoritarian processes yield majoritarian preferences. And even if they did, majorities, as such, impart no more moral legitimacy than any other fraction of the whole. In sum, it is terribly difficult to justify any moral conclusions, however much we may wish it were otherwise. Let me suggest, however, that the problem of moral skepticism is not an unmixed difficulty. For just as the arguments from skepticism frustrate the moral assertions one might wish to make, so too they frustrate the moral assertions of one's opponents. And ours is a time, let us note, of not a little moral and political passion. Those who would expand the state, for example, binding our economy and thwarting our liberties in the process, are fired in their efforts by high moral beliefs, by a zeal and a self-righteousness that often borders on the insufferable. How wonderful it is to use the arguments from skepticism to prick their moral pretensions. How delightful to show that they truly do not know what they are talking about, that their values, however selfless or, as is often the case, confused, in no way entail rights to reach in others' pockets, say. And even the tyrant, let us further note, is usually found dressed in the trappings of moral pretension. Whether in support of his favorite prohibitions, or in service of the Democratic People's Republic, or in furtherance of the Aryan race, even the tyrant, therefore, is ripe for moral undressing. In the end, however, it is good to have not only the explosive arguments from skepticism in one's arsenal, but a few affirmative arguments as well, or at least such arguments as can plausibly be generated. For there are those who will not dress their behavior with justificatory arguments, but instead will simply behave tout court, often to the detriment of others. Against these, the debunking arguments from skepticism will not avail. What is called for instead is an affirmative defense, an assertion not so much of no right on the part of one's opponent, but of right on one's own side. Yet even here, the insights from skepticism are useful, and not surprisingly, they stem in the modern form from Immanuel Kant, who was awakened from his dogmatic slumbers, as he put it, by the arguments of Hume. Rooting ethics in pure reason, rather than in the sentiment of the English empiricists or the values and virtues of the ancients, Kant attempted to formulate a principle of universalization such that morality would be a matter of rational consistency. In this, of course, he was building upon and refining the traditional arguments from the Golden Rule, which had always appealed to canons of logical consistency, at least by implication. But like those arguments, Kant never got it quite right. In particular, he never located precisely the content over which to universalize. Nevertheless, he has inspired many to the task, and in fact, the current rebirth of interest in rational ethics and law, which of course is a kind of naturalism, is largely in the Kantian tradition. The individuals who are working in this tradition are too numerous to mention here. Let me say, however, that in general they have all sought to locate a moral content over which to universalize such that all would be bound to accept the conclusions of obligation and correlative right entailed by that content. For the most part, however, these neo-Kantians have cast their substantive nets too broadly in order to get out the conclusions they wanted, and in the process have been unable to show why all must of necessity accept this content for themselves. The person who chooses to live in the welfare state, for example, is thereby bound to meet his welfare obligations when they come due. But from this, by no means does it follow that individuals are bound to choose to live in the welfare state in the first place. Are there features of the human condition, however, that in any way bind up front, as it were, such that if so, we would have a moral content over which to universalize that is at the same time necessary or ineluctable? In the few minutes that I have left, let me mention one recent line of argument that seems to meet this criterion, albeit not in its present form, which is also guilty of the overreaching to which I have just pointed. I refer to the work of one of my teachers at the University of Chicago, Professor Alan Gewirth, whose book, entitled Reason and Morality, has recently come out from the University of Chicago Press. In this work, and in an earlier series of articles, Professor Gewirth has reached the Kantian universalization principle from a theory of action, arguing even as against those who would not dress their behavior in justificatory garb, that in the very performance of conative acts, agents are necessarily, albeit implicitly, making right claims relating to the voluntariness or freedom that necessarily or inescapably characterizes those acts. Even in choosing not to act, for example, the agent is behaving conatively for purposes that seem good to him and hence that justify his acts to him, involving him in implicit right claiming. Because these claims are grounded in generic reasons that apply equally to all others, agents deny the similar right claims of others only on pain of contradicting themselves. It is in its fully developed form, then, and here I have barely mentioned the argument, it addresses the difficulties that have surrounded the Golden Rule, as well as the Kantian variations upon that rule. As Gewirth has presently formulated the argument, however, like these other Kantian theories, it is overextended, as mentioned earlier. In particular, quite a bit further down the line of argument, Gewirth wants to get out the welfare state. So he packs the foundations for this in the front of his argument. More precisely, as I have tried to show in some of my own work, he goes beyond the property foundations that alone can serve as necessary content to get the whole moral game off the ground. These property foundations will serve to get the ball rolling, as against the skeptic, but they will also serve to limit the course and direction of the roll, as against the moral overreacher, and as against such arguments as have come from Marx or Rawls or Dworkin, for example. I do believe, then, that we have here a significant advance toward realizing the age-old hope to be able to ground the fundamental principles of ethics in principles of reason. These principles, then, serve in turn to underpin the broad areas of the common law and, in time, the political order as well, which is the casuistry with which my own work has been primarily concerned in recent years. And it should be noticed that in all of this, consideration of value is needed only at the margin, which should comfort the economists who have rightly eschewed ethics for its subjectivity, but wrongly assumed that the whole of ethics is subjective. In this connection, the theory of rights is to be distinguished from the theory of value. If our rights can be grounded in principles of reason, then at least a part of ethics can be secured from the skeptic. Thus we have both surety in rights and relativity in values, the right to pursue whatever values we wish, provided only that we respect the equal rights of others in the process. In summary, then, I have moved over the course of these remarks from the very real problem of judicial review through the increasingly abstract issues of judicial method and normative ethics to the very ethereal matters of moral epistemology, in order to try to convey to you this morning something of the flavor of the current jurisprudential and moral debate, and to try to indicate as well what it is the judge must do, the range of issues he must confront if he is to go about his business conscientiously. Not surprisingly, Professor Dworkin, who endorses this approach to jurisprudence, to judgeship rather, calls his mythical judge Hercules. On the other hand, Professor Hart calls this approach the noble dream, as opposed to the nightmare, wherein the judge, unlike Hercules, simply calls the shots as he sees them, finding law and making law indifferently, often on his own intuitions, and often along lines described and even prescribed in the worst accounts of the school of legal realism, whose legacy we too often live with today. The truth of the matter about our judiciary, of course, at least insofar as it is possible to generalize about these matters, is that we live in a judicial regime that stands somewhere between the nightmare and the noble dream. Let me suggest, however, that we will not have better law until we move further in the direction of the noble dream. We all wish to live under the rule of law, not under the rule of men. But there are points in every political order at which the rule of law depends critically upon the rule of men. In our own order, we reach that point on the occasion of judicial review, when we are dependent upon both the intellectual and the moral integrity of the judge. These are qualities that are developed only in part by legal education. But insofar as they are, we in the Philadelphia Society would do well to turn our attention increasingly to this subject, which we have too little attended. And we would do well, too, to recognize that the legal realm does not come down to a matter of economics, materialism, and behaviorism on one side versus theology, spiritualism, and morality on the other. There is rather a middle ground of legal and moral rationalism that we inherited from the 18th century that has ever been at the heart of our political order, and it calls for our continuing attention. Thank you.